what's going to make them stick with you. If you put the consumer always at the middle of everything you're doing, then you can't go that wrong. One common mistake is to think that everything you do has to be scalable from the first day. It's a lot cheaper to retain a customer than get a new one. A year later, we were running the same testing and found that it completely changed. And with the rise in energy bills, the motivating trigger was much more about how can I save money on my energy bills. And if we hadn't kept listening, we'd have kept out with the messaging about being best for the environment and doing your bit.
Today, I'm joined by marketing expert Lucy Wolfden. She is the founder of the Startup Collective, a marketing agency that supports brands to reach their growth goals. Lucy has spent the last 20 years working in marketing. She started off working for creative agencies, and then she took on leadership roles for giants like Skype, Starling Bank, and Yolt. On today's episode, Lucy is going to talk about marketing and the various stages of a startup, from getting your first 10 customers to getting the next 100 and 1,000. Hello, Lucy. Welcome.
Hello. I'm so excited to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
I'm excited to explore this topic. Shall we get into the questions?
Definitely, let's do it.
Okay, great. So let's first start by getting an understanding of what is a good marketing strategy.
Oh, big question. I think the most important thing is always to go back to who are you targeting, what problem are you trying to solve, and what's going to make them stick with you. If you put the consumer always at the middle of everything you're doing, then you can't go that wrong, that tempting fate. But so I think that is where we would always start as well. We would always start by understanding and prioritizing who your target audience is. What problem are you really trying to solve? And who's out there looking for something like your solution already? And then thinking about, you know, what's happening externally that's going to push them towards something like you. What is it about you that's get you and your product or your service that's going to really attract them? And then what are the blockers? What are the inertias and anxieties that might stop them using your product or service? Often the case is someone will say, oh, we're for everybody, or, you know, we're for such a wide group. And that's brilliant. But at launch, unless you've got millions and millions in the bank, you don't tend to want to go for everyone. You want to go for specific groups. Then you want to really think about prioritizing that target audience and thinking about who are those lowest hanging fruit? Who can I get to first? And really start to build a reputation with this group and really do my testing and optimizing, learn a lot before I want to then scale and go out a lot further, spend a lot more money.
While you were just explaining that, I was just thinking about something that came to mind from the product side is we always talk about the early adopters and trying to get those early adopters. How do we know that somebody is really keen for your product versus somebody who's just saying, yeah, I'm interested in your product?
Such a good question. And it's really hard, isn't it? So many people will say, you know, we've got such a big waiting list and so many people are talking about how it's great. And then you send it out and send out the link to your beta product and no one downloads it. And it goes back to, is it a real problem you're solving? Are you going to help them solve a goal or solve something? And therefore, are they going to prioritize it? Because whichever group you're talking to, everybody's busy and there's always a lot of people want to do, but they're always going to prioritize the things they need to do. So that's where you really need to understand the problem and the trigger. What's that trigger that's going to make them do it now? So a lot, especially in this market, in this current climate where, especially B2B point of view, each spend and everything, every budget item is being scrutinized more. You really need to go from being a nice to have, or wouldn't that be lovely? And that would help me a bit to, this is going to save me X number of pounds or X number of hours a week. I need it now. And thinking about how you do that is really just getting out and talking to people, doing desk research to understand your audience better, talking to as many customers as you can, not just talking to the classics, your best friends and your family and everybody that's going to say what you want them to say. You need to get to the people that are really going to use it and really understand it. And I'm sure you do that when you're looking at that, getting to that first beta, And you know, those classic stages of alpha and beta and then soft launch. Going through those stages will save you money and save you time in the long run.
What would be in a customer response that would indicate that the problem that I'm looking at is really essential for the customer versus just something that's a nice to have?
Yeah, so I think one of the good indicators is, can they talk about the immediate value it's going to add to their life? And can they talk about use cases without having to be explained? There are some other factors, like can they use it easily? It's very different when it's B2C. It's often just a single decision maker. When it's B2B, it's slightly more complicated because you might have your single enthusiast that you're talking to during customer testing that's like, this is great, I'm going to love it. But is that person going to be able to sell it into the right decision makers internally to actually get it bought and used within the business?
Yeah, I think I've had an experience like that as well, where there was a decision maker who was responsible for solving a problem within the company, but the actual users were a different group. You need to make sure that it's a priority for those users too.
Yeah, and it's understanding the various different audience groups and different decision makers' problems that they want to solve, and then thinking about what's that overarching one, what messaging will really unite them and all agree. And that's really laddering back up to understanding what their OKRs are and what their objectives are that they need to hit. Because if they've got a quarterly objective that they're not hitting and they need to hit it, and your product will help them get there, then they're going to be wanting to bring it on and wanting to adopt it. But really, that is sort of the next stage of a marketing strategy. If you're thinking about how do people then sell it internally, how do you make it really easy for someone and make somebody look good by recommending your product to everybody else? So we often talk about within messaging the pub test. Can someone quickly explain what you do within a sentence? Because if they can't, they're not going to recommend it, because they won't look good if they can't really explain what it is and why someone should spend any money on it.
Thank you for sharing that. So let's just talk about what the different types of strategies might look like at the different types of stages that a founder might be at. So first of all, the initial stages is getting your first 10 customers. So you need to know where your customer number 1, 2, 3 is going to come from. What are some practical steps that somebody could take in order to get these first customers?
Yeah, so the very first customers, the way you tend to get, they tend to be got, isn't through a scalable means. It is about, whether it's B2B or B2C, it is about knocking on doors, getting out there, talking to small groups, really thinking about where your audience is and where they're likely to want to hear about something like yours. So is it an event? Is it a particular chat on a group chat on Facebook? Where are they? And where could you get those recommendations into that group? And so I think one common mistake is to think that everything you do has to be scalable from the first day. And it really doesn't, because what you're trying to do is start to build momentum, get the users that can then give you the testimonials and the case studies and the referrals and start that growth. Because really, you're not looking to scale until you've found the classic product market fit, or at the point that you know you've got a product that your audience want and need and are going to keep using.
What are your thoughts on using paid advertising at this stage?
Yeah, it's a difficult one, and it really depends on who your audience is. So if you're a B2C low ticket app, then you probably could do some paid to drive it. We often use paid for message testing and audience testing in the first place. It's often a cheap way that also drives some interest. But really, depending on what you're looking at, say, for example, we do a lot within fintech. One of the biggest barriers to any product is trust. And you're not necessarily going to build trust to a meta ad that leads directly to an app. What you need is to find the people that your audience trust and get them to refer it and get them to start talking about it. And you'll see a much higher return on that. So often if it's a B2C, it could be TikTok or Facebook influencers. If it's a financial product, it might be LinkedIn or Twitter or X. Thinking about who it is going to convince your target audience to take that first step and to try it. Often your very first users are people you know and trust. A lot of founders that we work with, so they face this problem already within their industry, and that's why they're starting it. So they already know who their first customers are, especially the big ticket items. They've already worked within that industry for years and they already have a good network that they can go to, and people will just understand it. I'm not against paid advertising, but what you don't want to be doing is just thinking that you can throw loads of money at Meta and hope that will drive long-term growth. It will just be a very expensive mistake.
Yeah, and I guess with your first few customers, you're still very much learning about who your customer might be. I think with the paid advertising, you need to be quite specific about who you're targeting in order for it to actually reach the people that you want it to reach. Is that true?
It very much depends which channel it is. So LinkedIn, that's very true. You can be really specific about job type, business, messaging, group, central groups that they're in, etc. For Meta, it's very much creative-led targeting. The way that the algorithm has been developed, it's very much about they want you just to put in the ads and use the messaging to find the right target, and then they will optimize towards that target. It does depend on the channel that you're in. It's a difficult conundrum that founders often have, which is, when should I bring a paid specialist in? When should I use an agency? Because if you're only spending a few hundred or even a few thousand pounds a month on paid media, it just doesn't make sense to use 50% of that on a fee. But what you would want, and what a lot of the paid media specialists would do, is come in and be paid by the hour to help you set up those initial campaigns. So at least you can start off on the right foot, especially if your Metas and they're very much easy to use and user friendly. So I would suggest getting some advice, making sure you set up right, but then really driving it yourself until you get to a sizable media spend.
For the people that aren't used to putting themselves on social media and data, which is the whole new thing, probably many people didn't expect themselves to be in this position where they're all of a sudden having to be the face of a new company and trying to sell a product. Any advice?
It's really hard. Perhaps not LinkedIn, but every other channel. It's very hard to grow organically. So do not expect overnight results from something like that. And especially for B2B brands, it's really important to have a presence, but your social channels might be more about people using that to check that you are who you say you are, that you're not a fake, especially if you're advertising on those channels, rather than it being a high growth channel. It obviously completely depends on the brand, but really investing in time and effort. If you want to, say, use organic TikTok as your growth channel, you need to invest time and effort into thinking about the right content that you want to be putting out. So what is it that your audience are looking for? What trends are they following? And then really being consistent and making sure you keep an eye out on what other people are doing, what's working, what's not, and building on that. But it will take time. So a bit of patience is always useful.
Let's go on to talking about the 10 to 100 now. How might this differ from the first group of users?
You should just know a little bit more about what's working, what's not, what people are reacting well to, what's really driving growth, and who are the people that will go onto your product or service and stay. That's who you want. It isn't about the vanity install rate. It's about who is going to keep on, because it's a lot cheaper to retain a customer than get a new one. So you're really looking for that lifetime value and increasing the value of each customer. You'll know a little bit more about them, and therefore you can really hone in on what the core growth levers you think are working for you. I carry on talking to them. Content is always going to be king, whatever you're doing. So thinking about, what content are you delivering? Are you making sure you're answering all the questions? What are they searching for? What else are they doing with? Who are they listening to? And building around that and starting to think about, organic growth loops that might help to drive growth? Are there connections within your audiences? Can you encourage people to refer their friends or refer other colleagues? What can you start testing and learning about that's really going to drive that growth? Try and focus, because one thing that we see a lot of people at this stage doing is just throwing lots of mud at the wall and seeing what sticks and trying 100 different things. And you're likely to be getting so much different advice. So it's really, so, and people, everybody has an idea. Everybody has an opinion on what you should be doing. And just taking that advice by having a filter, so really knowing and being clear about what you know that's worked and what your audience is saying they need and what they're looking for. And that will always help you steer through all the meaning advice to stick to a few good things.
Would you mind giving an example of getting to know your customer a little bit more compared to before?
Yes, what you'll have seen and is not just what people say in the research, what people say in the interviews. You'll be seeing their real behavior. And say you're talking about an app-based product, you'll be seeing why they're coming back, the sort of reason, the feedback you're initially getting, what they thought they'd want to get from your product or service and what they're actually getting from it. Twitter started as a dating site and then eventually came a chat app. It's really understanding what problem are you really solving. And we interviewed this week, it was a really interesting one from Marty AI. So they started off, they knew that they wanted to solve the problem of obesity. And so they started off with micro stores within London, healthy but convenient food. They scaled quite quickly. They were making revenue by month six, which for any startup is dreamlike. But what they worked out was when they were doing that, they were also developing a system that meant that they could be more efficient with the stock they have and understanding when people were going to buy certain things and making sure they kept that in, which was making them more efficient, but also driving more revenue. And they realized that was their real goal. That could be their real product and their real service was not the physical microstores themselves, but this software that they could offer to the whole of the grab and go market, which is huge in the UK, plus globally and to other people. And really they've accelerated their growth now as soon as they realized that. But they wouldn't have noticed at the first. At first, they became a physical retail store, and now there's a piece of software.
Great example. And so now moving on to the 100 to the 1,000, how would this look different?
I suppose you probably got a little bit either more revenue or some more funding at this stage, because you're really getting to product market fit. You're probably going for at least seed at this stage. And therefore, you're thinking more about developing a marketing team, even if it's one or two people, and thinking about probably investing more into long-term brand as well as growth. So thinking about how can you really start to cut a bigger piece of the pie for the market that you're in, or developing more. So thinking about what skills do you need in-house? What you'll know by now is what's really driven that first 100, what's really worked. Another example is Frolo, which is an app for single parents. They grew initially on an Instagram page, and once they got to 20,000 followers, they knew that actually they'd be able to build into an app. But what they really knew is what drove growth was this community, was building a community where people felt they could be open and safe, they could get the support they needed and really flourish with friendships. So that was always going to be their core growth strategy, was how can you build a community that matters? So yeah, so slightly more budget, slightly more people, more defined goals. So you'll be a lot closer to the analytics of it all. You still want to be testing and learning. I don't think you ever get to a stage where you're not testing and learning. A good example of this is we worked with a sustainability business for the last year. Before the economic downturn, the research was saying that the most compelling reason someone would choose it would be because they wanted to make the world a better place and they wanted to use less carbon. A year later, we were running the same testing and found that it completely changed. And with the rise of energy bills, the motivating trigger was much more about how can I save money on my energy bills. And if we hadn't kept listening, we'd have kept out with the messaging about being better to the environment and doing your bit. And although that's still motivating, it wouldn't have got people to invest in the tool at that time. But telling them they could save money on their energy bills, which is the problem that they're facing at that moment, was compelling. So it is always about understanding what's going on around you, not just with your core competitors, but all around your customer, the problems they're having, that where they're at, and what other alternatives they might be looking at.
That's really interesting. So I think one thing that came, how much time should somebody be spending on their marketing in the very beginning?
What you want to do, rather than just thinking purely about marketing, it's just making sure that everything you're building and everything you're thinking about and everything you're planning is based on the consumer. Are you solving a problem? Have you checked? Is it something they need? So really, everything comes back to that. And for me, that is marketing, because without it, there isn't a marketing plan. If you stick marketing on the end after you've built everything and then go sell this, if nobody wants it, how much money you throw at it, you're not going to be successful. So really, it's starting at the very beginning, as you've set your why, your purpose in life of what you want to achieve. But really, to think of that solution, you need to be thinking about the customer straight away.
So it's like a loop that's constantly...
And constant doing. And that's where really you could say that that's as much product as it is marketing. But really, the more you can work together cross-functionally and work as a team to all reach that same goal and keep that front and centre for every conversation, every pound spent, then you'll just have a much easier route to market.
Yeah. And in the very beginning, when you're just trying to find your first, say, like your 100, 200 customers, and these days social media is used a lot, I myself have found myself like thinking, am I now an influencer? Like trying to become an influencer, because it takes a lot of time. Do you have any advice on like how to balance that content creation with, I don't know, like creating your product? Or because it's like a real grind.
It definitely does. And I think some accountability, setting in, putting in some accountability so that you know you're doing it, so you're definitely doing it, really helps. I think setting aside time, having a really clear structure of what is it that you talk about, why would people know you, brainstorming that, then having chunks of time where you're creating that content so that you're not thinking every morning, oh God, I've got to write a LinkedIn post, oh God, I've got to do an Instagram reel, because that just takes up too much time and nobody has enough time or energy for that. But where you really think, what is it that people want to listen to me about? And that's not generally just about your product or service. It might be something bigger. If you think about Rachel Corral, who's the Coria Kids founder, although she's got a nanny, an app for nannies, what she talks about and the reason people follow her is about childcare reform and how she's lobbying the government and what the changes are and how that's going and the reality of the situation. And that's much more interesting than her talking about her product every day. And that's led to growth, but it isn't just sales, sales, sales. So really think about what's interesting, what's going to create interest, what's going to create conversation, and then think about what can you actually fit into your working week. And then just be consistent. So if it's being consistent, posting 3 times a week or every day, and sticking to the channels that matter. Like, don't think, God, I have to be across TikTok, Instagram, LinkedIn, X, Telegram, everything. Think, what's really going to move the dial in the first instant? Who are that prioritized first target segment I want to get to? Where are they? What can I be doing? And just focus and drill down into them, because it'll save you time and energy and hopefully get you some results.
Some great advice there. What would the different methodologies look like for B2B versus B2C?
Yeah, so it's a good question. The base of they want doesn't change. What does change is quantity. So if you're a high ticket B2B where you're expecting annual recurring revenue from a client to be 100,000 to a million, and have a very different strategy to a low ticket B2C that's asking for a fiver a month. So the differences are often the quantity in terms of acquisition. The second one is then the decision making time. The higher ticket B2Bs are much longer decision making time. It's not uncommon for that to be 12, 18 months from starting to reach out to actually getting a deal done. Whereas again, for a lower ticket B2C, people are often easily come on, easily trial, and your job isn't purely acquisition, it's just getting them to stick. Mm. So they might download the app, but then you've got a whole effort and focus to really get them to stick and to keep using it and keep reminding them why they're there and what they can be doing and how it's helping them. So they're the sort of differences. And then you're just looking at channels, and it's nothing to say that there is some great examples of businesses doing well on TikTok. So it's not just B2B, it isn't just like LinkedIn's for B2B, TikTok's for B2C. It's again back to, where are your target customer? Where do they want to hear from you? Because it might be that your audience are on TikTok, but they're on it to like just get away from work for 5 minutes. So they don't want to be getting work messages and it being targeted about that. They're going to swipe on by. But so, you know, it's thinking about that. And again, just go and ask them, find out where they are and what they're doing, and literally what your competitors and alternatives are doing, and get inspiration from them. There's so much advice and so many different ways you can do it. Mm. But yeah, keep focused.
Let's talk about raising awareness for a product versus a customer who already knows they have a problem and actually needs a product, because there is a difference, I think. Especially, I have found, even that she found, that a lot of people don't realize that they might need some support in turning their idea into their first product. If they don't come from a tech background, they might not necessarily not know what methodology to use. So for example, there are people that would just invest all their money into building a product even before doing any testing, for example. So in that case, that kind of person, that group of people, they don't know that they need something.
I think it's a really good question. It's often, we work with a lot of challenges, and often they don't have it. They're trying to do something different. And you're completely right. They don't know that solution's out there. So they're not looking for something like you. They're thinking there's a different way that they need to solve it. And that might be them doing it themselves and feeling the pain and getting it wrong and wasting time and money. So I think there are a few things you can do. One is about thinking about, how can you tell your story fastest and get to them the fastest? We do a lot of strategic partnerships in the first place to say, there's someone like you, someone that has, or a brand or a product or service that has a similar audience, but you're non-competing. Can you do a partnership, a co-creative partnership, value exchange with them so you're getting in front of them? A really simple example is when I first started Scale Up, I did a lot of webinars with Seed Legals because they're a legal tech that are targeting startups. So the value exchange was, I could come and tell them all about how to launch a product. The value back to me was, I get in front of a couple of hundred startups every time I speak. And that led to clients, and it led to value on that side and value for me. So just thinking about that, and then always just going in with the easiest way. So I think that's a good way to sort of get started and think about that. There's some really awesome partnerships out, and they can scale and be quite complicated. You can integrate products with them, but first we'll start in with that lowest hanging fruit. At Yelton Starling, we did a lot of just creating marketing partnerships. So it might be co-hosting events, it might be co-creating a piece of content or a webinar, but a quick way to test whether audiences will take up on that.
Let's move on to talking about what some of the general mistakes that you see commonly are.
Yeah, I think it's a really good question. I think sometimes it's just being quite sporadic and inefficient with what you're trying to do. And the common term is throw mud at the wall and see what sticks. So it's just, always coming up with a new idea and wanting to go out and try it. And every week there being a different idea. Consistency is so important in marketing that if you keep doing that, like you might, there might be a quick win that turns into your golden ticket, but the likelihood is you're just going to stick and be exhausted and confuse everybody because you're going out with different messaging every week. You're appearing in different places every week. What you need is to consistently understand. Another one might be actually just bringing in a sales team or putting loads of money into paid too quickly. So just trying those, you know, quick wins of the expensive mistakes until you really know what you're selling, whether it's via sales team or via paid. You need to be clear on what you're selling and who you're selling it to really get any traction. And just an extension of that, if you've got a sales flow that takes 12 to 18 months, giving a sales team 3 to 6 months to really succeed is probably not going to work. Another one might be spending a ton of money on your brand or your website. The amount of time someone's come to me and said, I spent 50 grand on my website, but we've pivoted and now it's not right. And me looking at the website and not really seeing where that value is coming from. Start small and get bigger. And you spend on things when you're really clear about it. And that doesn't mean don't value brand. You should value brand from the beginning, but your brand means what do you mean to people? How can you relate to people? How can you deliver value? How can you be important to people? That's what that means versus let's go out and spend a fortune on branding, look and feel and expensive videos or expensive website. They're really vanity projects and they're not going to really help you scale.
Yeah, this branding was one of my later questions. So let's go into that because I wanted to understand how much time should somebody actually spend on branding in the beginning, especially when you're like figuring things out. Because I think it's natural to dive straight into a solution because you think your idea is great and you want to give it like a personality. Realistically, in the beginning, let's just say, just to make it a little bit more tangible, finding your first customers, like you're under 100?
There's a few different things. So no sort of one answer, but it is really about being efficient and thinking about what you need to do to get to the next stage. So if you set goals of, right, okay, I need to get to X, I need to get to Y, versus I want to be the global phenomenon of Z, will help you move quickly. I think brand is often underrated and the importance of brand, but I think people misunderstand exactly what brand really means. And the brand is the connection with you and your audience. So that doesn't mean I need to spend a lot of money on my logo and my website. It means I want to spend a lot of time adding value to my customers. One thing you will come up against is, and you need to question at each point, is what is my minimum viable website? What is my minimum X? And when you're thinking about that, is are your target audience going to get to that and believe that you're trusted or believe you're something, that you're real? You know, how do you add that confidence and that social proof into any of your elements that people are going to come to along their journey so that they will trust you and they will go further? Because the likelihood is they could go to something much more sophisticated and much more trustworthy, that they know more people that have used. What is it that's going to make them choose you? So it is finding that minimum viable part at each point. Mm. But really thinking about it from day one and brand it. How can you communicate? Going back to that point earlier, what is that pub test for your brand? Can people explain why they like it or why they want it or why they would use it? Because if they can't, they probably won't use it and they won't recommend it. So focusing on those points early on.
And is it something that can evolve as the company evolves, or is it something that's quite static?
No, I mean, brands want to keep consistently evolving. And it's an interesting one, actually. So, I mean, some of the big high street brands, like Nationwide, is just rebranded, Square rebranded not so long ago, controversially exited. You'll always see, and there'll be some things that the general customer just won't notice. Slightly changing the font or the hue of the colour isn't going to make a massive difference. But is there a real step change people need at any stage of the journey? I see everything as an evolution. You never get to the bit where you go, right, we've got a marketing strategy, that's it. We've got a brand strategy, that's it. We've got anything. You never just end. It's always constantly iterating and constantly improving, constantly listening so that you can scale.
Yeah, I went to the Brand Museum in London.
Oh, amazing.
Which is in Notting Hill. And it was a really nice place. I found it and I thought, let's go and check it out. I don't know much about branding. But what was amazing is that some brands are like over 100 years old or 200. Like, it's, I don't know, want to say 200 because I don't know if that's true. Is it? No.
Yeah.
Definitely. Is that possible? But it was really amazing. It was really interesting to see some products had their basic images hadn't changed, but just very slightly evolved to meet the current trends. Especially, it was very visible during the Edwardian and Victorian times, where everything was quite flowery and frilly, and now everything's more minimalist and like contemporary looking. So it was very different. That was really interesting. I definitely get everyone to go and see that. Yeah,
it's an interesting one. We were actually doing focus groups yesterday on the development and evolution of a brand that's over 100 years old, and it's interesting how different people relate to that. And from using Nationwide as an example, talking to the younger demographic, they felt it was necessary to feel relevant to them and to keep them staying with a brand like Nationwide, whereas the older demographic just didn't even notice and was wondering why they were spending time thinking about what their logos looked like when they should have been spending time improving the interest rate. So it's a really interesting one, isn't it? And I think you've got to make sure, again, back to your audience, back to your customer, what is going to be the point of evolving and what is going to help us get to this next stage of growth, whether that's your first one or your 100th step.
Great. Okay, so let's move on to the next question. What are the areas that people mainly struggle with in outreach?
We all get hit by a lot of emails or messages that are just so sales driven. I had one the other day that was actually just like angry at me because I hadn't responded to a cold outreach. I just thought that was quite, didn't think aggressive was going to be a tone that I would get from that. Understanding what channels should you focus on? Email still is very strong. Newsletters are still very strong. Cold outreach is a numbers game, but it's also just making sure you think about that whole flow. So most people, if you are going to do cold email, most people don't reply to the first email. They might reply to the second or third. They might reply to that. You start an email, but then you go to LinkedIn. They might reply on LinkedIn and not on there because they haven't seen you because you've gone to spam. But thinking about segmenting that outreach, and again, just being specific, thinking about what is important to them, what's going to open their eyes, what is their problem, so that you can talk about solving it, and that's what's going to get them to pick it up. For some cases, it still is pick up the phone, others it's WhatsApp. Thinking about your context, where and channel, and making sure, and just again testing it and send a few, see if you get a good response. If you get some awful responses, improve, iterate, take learnings. One thing that people always forget with email is just that the subject and first line is 80% of the job. People aren't going to open it unless it's the right subject header. So they spend so long on the email, but they don't think about that title. So nobody ever gets read. And that's the same with direct mail as well. You've got the job with the envelope to do before people read the letter.
Mm. Yeah.
Direct mail has been having a comeback the last few years, though. But it's a much more expensive route to market than others.
How has AI impacted outreach and the way people do marketing now?
I think there's so much conversation around it and views on either side and people getting very offended. And I just think I heard Huffman, who was one of the founders of Netflix, talk about it as amplification intelligence. And I think that is the best way you can do it. It's not replacing you, it's just helping you do your job better and quicker. And if that's about getting inspiration from ChatGPT or saving some time with research, desk research by using Chat or Gemini, then go for it. If it's about thinking about using one of the AI tools for outreach that helps you find your audience quicker than paying for somebody to scroll through countless reams to get to the right one, or to use it to check that email's correct, then go for it. I mean, it's not stopping, it's just meaning you can move quicker, but using it in a very mindful way. I can't stand the AI bots that comment on my LinkedIn posts. It's so obvious. Don't use it. You're not going to create relationships if it's not person to person, but it can shortcut. So we use it as an example. We do a LinkedIn Live most Mondays. We then use this check take this. Otter is an AI tool that turns it, takes, creates a transcript from the video that we use on StreamYard. We then stick it in with the right prompt into ChatGPT, which gets to the body of our blog. Then obviously it gets humanized and tweaked and change, but it saves us a couple of hours of transcribing a half an hour video and getting that first part down. So I see that as a time save. I don't see that as devaluing any piece of content. I see it as a brilliant tool that I will shout about and tell everyone to do too.
Thank you so much for sharing all that information. Shall we move into our lightning round? What's one book or podcast do you listen to that you could recommend?
Okay, so I'm a bit of a book geek. I always have a business book and a fiction book on the go. From a consumer point of view, I really love Mike Stevens' Direct-to-Consumer Playbook. I think it's just really useful. Each chapter is a different case study on how well-known brands launched and went to market in the first place, and you know, what was the first tactics that worked for them. And I think that's so much more useful for a non-marketing founder than any marketing strategy book will be. Podcast-wise, there are tons, but I really like Dan Murray's Letter to Secret Leaders, especially on, I think it, there's loads of insights. So I really love the shorts about the best failures. I think that works really well. And it's also just really comforting if you're going through a hard time.
If you had one wish, what would it be?
The one wish is probably a bit of patience. I think everybody thinks they're going to find the right route to market quickly, and they want to move really quickly, but often they miss out on the crucial first steps. And if you miss out on actually doing a bit of planning and thinking about it in the first place, it means that you get 3 months, 6 months down the line and you haven't moved forward as much as if you just spent a bit more time at the beginning, not months, but just a little bit more time digging in and really understanding what's going to work for you. And that investment at the beginning will pay off tenfold by month six. And often we often talk to people that have just wanted to get out there and do it. And that's brilliant. And I'm all for that. But let us just think about making sure that we're also thinking short and long term before we go anywhere.
Great advice there. Thank you. Which one piece of advice has been given to you that served you well?
I think you don't have to know everything. I definitely don't know anything, and I'm 20 odd years into my career. Having that confidence that it's okay not to know everything, because if you don't ask questions, you don't admit, you don't ask for advice, and launching your product or doing anything, it's the same as that quote about family. It takes a village to raise a child. It takes a village to build a brand. And so ask for advice, know what you don't know, and bring in the right people. And if someone's talking about something you don't know about it, don't understand, don't pretend you don't think you should do, just ask, because it could be a really simple answer and you move a lot quicker.
Before we end this session, it would be great to give you a bit of time to just share how people can connect to you and what you're working on at the moment.
We're at thescaleupcollective.com. So please come and visit our website. And also I'm on LinkedIn a lot. So come and find me. I'm Lucy Wolfenden. So that would be wonderful.
Great. Thank you so much for sharing that. If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast episode today, please do hit the subscribe button and share this episode with like-minded connections. I'd also like to take this opportunity to let you know that I'm sharing knowledge on how to build tech products. If this sounds like something that's going to be helpful to you, please subscribe to the She Founds newsletter. The link will be in the show notes.